anticipation. All right, well, thank you for the organizers for the invitation to speak. So what I'm going to talk about now is practical solutions to hard problems. And in particular, I want to start with explaining to you what is known about what kinds of problems in three-dimensional topology have algorithmic solutions. So in particular, in contrast with higher dimensions, there are in fact many properties of three manifolds which are algorithmically decidable. So in this talk, I'm thinking of some smooth, compact three manifold. You should think maybe the three sphere or the torus, the three-dimensional torus, or one of the surface bundles that Saul was talking about before lunch. So in contrast to, say, in dimension 5, where it's known that there's no algorithm that will decide, for instance, if a manifold is a five-dimensional sphere, because in high dimensions you run into problems about every finitely presented group is a fundamental group of some manifold, and questions about finitely presented groups, like the word problem and the isomorphism problem, and generically, they're not decidable. In contrast, there are a number of things we can decide about three manifolds. So for instance, starting with the work of Hawken in the 1960s, he showed that you can decide whether or not a knot in the three sphere is the unknot. Right? So this is what Joel Haas was talking about yesterday. We have some loop embedded, some circle embedded in R3 or S3, and then sometimes it's the trivial thing, it bounds a disk. So this is an example of a trivial knot. If you were to grab this and kind of pull and shake it, it would you know, like a rubber band, it would undo itself. And so Hawken used something which are called normal surfaces to search for things like disks bounded by curves like this, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. And so in addition to doing things like deciding if a knot is the unknot, Hawken gave ways of supposing looking at the two-dimensional homology of our manifold M, any class, and that can be represented by a nice smooth oriented surface sitting in our three manifold. You could ask, well, what's the smallest genus of that surface? And again, Hawken said that that's possible to answer that question in an algorithmic way. And there's other classes of surfaces for which this is the case. So one important class of surfaces in three-dimensional topology are those that are incompressible. So we have some surface. In this talk, all surfaces in three manifolds or whatever are orientable. This is not a real assumption, but it just aids the exposition. So we have some surface F embedded in our three manifold. This is incompressible. If, well, I don't want this manifold to be the two sphere, and if I look at the map on the fundamental group from this surface into the three manifold, this should be injective. So what it's saying is we have a surface sitting in our three manifold, and we cannot, for instance, take a loop on that surface and crush that loop to a point in the ambient manifold. But after all, every three manifold is locally like R3, and so near any point in your three manifold, there's a little surface of genus 19 sitting there. It tells you absolutely nothing about the global topology of the manifold. These, on the other hand, these surfaces are very much the opposite of that, and they turn out to tell you lots about the three manifold when they happen to be there. And they're not always there. So like manifold like S3 will have no incompressible surfaces. And Jekyll and Ortel gave an algorithm to decide whether or not you have such a surface. And I mentioned in high dimensions, you can't decide if a manifold is the three sphere, is the n-dimensional sphere, but in dimension 3, you can. So there is an algorithm that, given some combinatorial description of a three manifold, like gluing tetrahedra together, you can decide if it's the three sphere. And Kasten showed that this allows you to do the connected sum decomposition. So for three manifolds, again, unlike in higher dimensions, any three manifold is a connected sum of some finite number of three manifolds which can no longer be decomposed by this process, and this decomposition is essentially unique. So in fact, the first step in most topological problems in three manifolds is you look at just these prime, as they're called, pieces, and Kasten showed that knowing whether being able to decide if a three manifold is a three sphere allows you to compute that as well. And I mentioned these incompressible surfaces are an important class of surface. And in fact, it's so important that manifolds that contain them have a special name. So a manifold that contains an incompressible surface and is prime, it's not decomposable under this connected sum operation, are called Hockin, and work starting with Hockin and culminating noticeably later showed that it's possible to decide, if you give me two Hockin manifolds, you can decide whether or not they're homeomorphic. And by this thing, you can actually, if I give you a manifold, you can also decide if it's Hockin. Now these theorems are all based on this technique, normal surfaces, that I'll talk about in a minute, but purely topological techniques are not the only tools we have in three-dimensional topology. In particular, the work of Thurston and Perlman tells us that three manifolds have some kind of particularly symmetric geometries. Roughly speaking, the geometrization theorem says that a three manifold has a canonical decomposition. For this talk, it's not important exactly what that decomposition is. It involves undoing connected sums, and there's a corresponding torus sum that you want to get rid of. Let's not focus on that. Instead, focus on the thing that says these manifolds, these pieces, have geometric structures, which means they have Riemannian metrics, which are locally homogeneous. So they look the same near every point. And it turns out in dimension 3, that means there are exactly 8 possibilities for this local geometry. Either you have a manifold where the geometry is flat, so it's a Euclidean manifold, or it has the geometry of the round 3 sphere, so for instance a lens space, or it's a hyperbolic manifold. That's the generic case, the most important. And then there are 5 others, sphere cross the line, hyperbolic plane cross the line, various three-dimensional Lie groups. And again, there's this cutting involved, but for many manifolds, there's some topological condition you can put on it, so there are no cuttings. So you should think of this as saying that if you give me a three manifold, there's a good chance it's going to have, in particular, a hyperbolic structure on it. And if it doesn't, then it's going to have some variant of that or something that you get by some cutting. And this, the existence of this hyperbolic generically structure on a manifold turns out to give you very powerful tools for understanding it computationally. So as a consequence of the geometrization theorem proved by Perlman, the work on the sort of topological approach to algorithms and the work of any number of additional people, it turns out that the following question is actually decidable. So there is an algorithm. Sorry about that. Here, I'm just going to go fix this. My apologies. Where is it? I click it. Not very happy. Aye, aye, aye. Oh, never mind. Okay. Okay, so it turns out that if you give me 2 compact 3 manifolds, so you give me some triangulations of them, specifying some gluing of tetrahedra, there doesn't exist an algorithm to determine whether those 2 manifolds I was handed are in fact homeomorphic. And it depends very strongly on the existence of these geometric structures, and it uses those geometric structures, their invariants and so on, to tell the manifolds apart. So there are other directions about computation in three-dimensional topology I'm not going to talk about. Question? Yes. It's given as a list. So my manifold is built up out of some tetrahedron, and so it's given as a list of instructions: glue this face to this face by a map like that. So and dimension down, right? What you should be thinking of is it's like being given a list of triangles and then being told some way of identifying these things together, which in this case, I guess I glue these two together. And I get, in this case, that was a description of the two-dimensional torus. So that would be the form in which I'm thinking of my three manifolds as being specified. There are other ways, other common topological descriptions, they can all be converted into this form. Other questions? So there are other directions and other interesting questions about computing about computing things about three manifolds, since it's coming out of gauge theory. There's now a highly effective version of floor homology that tells you all sorts of topologically interesting things. That turns out to be actually effectively computable, and that turns out to the kind of thing actually answers many questions that are inaccessible from the geometric point of view of Thurston and Perlman. That's not what I'm going to be talking about today, but maybe I thought I needed to tell you that it was there. So how hard are these questions? So this is something that Joel touched on in his talk yesterday. So for instance, here's a particular problem which is known to be NP complete. So I guess if it's a problem in NP, I should state it as a decision problem. So the question is given a manifold, so a three manifold specified by its triangulation by gluing a bunch of tetrahedra together, and then I have some knot in my three manifold, which pictorially I would draw as a nice smooth embedded curve, but in my combinatorial description I'm thinking about as a union of edges in my triangulation of the manifold. So that's in the one skeleton as it's called. And suppose you give me a genus, ask, does this surface bound a surface whose boundary is the knot? So I shouldn't have drawn this picture. I should have drawn a different one. So this is a picture of what's called the trefoil knot in the three sphere. It's the boundary of a surface, orientable surface. The genus of the surface is? The surface is a surface of genus 1. So this is a knot in the three sphere which bounds a surface of genus 1. It doesn't bound a surface of genus 0, which is to say it's not the same as the simply unknotted curve which bounds a disk. So anyway, this is a question. Given a manifold with a knot in it, given a genus, is there a surface which bounds, whose boundary is that curve, whose genus is at most G? And the answer is, it's going to drive me nuts. You too, probably. Does there exist a surface with genus G? And so this, Egolhaas and Bill Thurston showed that this problem is, in fact, NP-complete. Okay, so that puts it in the same class of problems like traveling salesmen and so on that we can solve in some cases. They're thought not to be able to have an algorithm which solves them in polynomial time, and so they're fairly difficult, although not in any given instance necessarily intractable. And there are other results of this kind. So Kassin et al. Showed that it's possible the question we had earlier about recognizing the three sphere, the algorithm of Rubinstein and Thompson, it turns out that is a problem which is also in NP. Sorry? Which NP complete problem is this reduced to? It's reduced to 3-fat. So it turns out that the way this works is you create a manifold with a tremendous amount of mod 2 homology. This ends up being very large. And the thing is then, if we're trying to find a surface of genus G, well, it's going to live in some homology class here, and there are many different homology classes it could live in. And so the way you do it is you set it up is somehow that you encode the 3-fat problem in this homology. Those are your binary variables, and that's what you do. So that's why it's NP hard. The reason it's NP complete, I'll explain in a minute. Other questions? So now I want to turn to to the ideas of Hawken about normal surfaces, which are the key topological tool that are used in these kind of computations. So what is a normal surface? A normal surface is simply, it's a surface, so that tetrahedron there, that's one of the tetrahedra in our triangulation of our manifold. And the condition is that a surface is normal means that when you intersect it with any of the tetrahedra, it looks like a bunch of planes slicing through the tetrahedra. Okay. So in particular, there are basically seven different ways that you can do this. You can either slice off a corner, or you can break your vertices into two pairs, take a plane that separates those two pairs, and in that case you cut off a quadrilateral, like in that middle. And there's three of those quadrilaterals that you can have. So in particular, if I wanted to specify a picture like this, what I could do is I could tell you seven numbers, which describe the number of triangles in the top corner, that would be two, the number of triangles in that corner, which would be one, the number of quadrilaterals of this particular kind, which is one, all the other data would be zero. Okay. And so we could then think, if we have a normal surface, for each tetrahedron we have seven numbers assigned to it, seven non-negative integers, and so we can think about it as a lattice point in a certain, well, in R to the 7T. Now, of course, not every choice of numbers like this comes from some kind of actual honest surface in our three-dimensional manifold, right? Because, well, in particular, if here we have two tetrahedra, which are glued together, so I'm going to glue this face to this face, just bringing them together like this. If I have a surface over here, perhaps consists of one triangle and one quadrilateral, and maybe over here I had one that just consisted of a single triangle, then if I try to glue those together, I'm not getting an actual surface. I mean, I could glue this thing to this thing here, but then this thing, I mean, it would just run along this edge, and it would sort of stop. It wouldn't be a closed surface. So the condition that we need, if we focus here on just the triangle, which is the common boundary of these two tetrahedra, what we want is that we're going to see a picture like this. Our surface is going to intersect that triangle in a bunch of arcs that run from one side to the other, and what we need is that the number of arcs coming from this side is the same as the number of arcs coming from this side. Right, so if I had put two triangles here instead of one, then I would be able to match this up with this and match this up with that. So if I had variables corresponding to the number of triangles or the number of quadrilaterals, here's another quadrilateral here, the number of triangles here and the number of quadrilaterals here, then the condition that you need in order to have these actually honestly match up is simply that W1 plus W2 is equal to V1 plus V2. So if I give you an integer, a vector in R to the 7T with integer entries, if it satisfies this condition, then it's going to correspond to some surface in our manifold. And so we can think of these normal surfaces as the integer lattice points in some kind of polyhedral cone, right? Because we have this condition here which is linear, and of course we also have the condition that doesn't make sense to talk about the number of negative copies of a triangle, minus 17 triangles, makes no sense. And so we have a bunch of linear equalities and inequalities. They define some kind of polyhedral cone in this ginormous dimensional Euclidean space, and then the normal surfaces correspond to the lattice points in this cone. Are there any questions? Okay. So, why is this useful? Well, it turns out there's a principle that repeats in any number of specific theorems, which I won't state, that if you're looking at an interesting class of surfaces, then there will be one, there'll be at least one member of that class which is normal. So the idea is typically you start with some surface in your manifold. It's just some surface. You make it maybe transverse to the edges of our triangulation. It's not going to be normal, but the idea is that there might be moves. You can move it around, pull it tight or whatever, and make it into a normal surface. So there are many classes of surface for which this is true. And that's helpful in the sense it reduces the, you know, huge space of all possible embeddings of surfaces into your manifold to some countable collection of tuples of numbers describing normal surfaces. But that's not going to give you an algorithm because there's going to be infinitely many things. And so there's a second part to most of these theorems which say, actually, if you have an interesting surface like this, there's one that's normal, and moreover, there's one that lies on the a vertex ray of this convex cone. All right, so these are homogeneous linear conditions, so the solution set has scale invariant. There will be some vertices on this which lie on those edges. Those are what are called the vertex solutions. And so there's theorems which tell you, for instance, that the minimal genus of a surface whose boundary is a given knot, maybe that genus in that picture is 1, there will always be a normal surface of genus 1 whose boundary is not, that's one of these things here. And so that then becomes a finite check. And Joel didn't go into the details yesterday when he was talking about these upper bounds on the number of Rademeister moves needed to take a diagram and turn it into unknot. They come from this analyzing the complexity of this situation. This is Hawkins' original algorithm for deciding if a knot is knotted. Now the problem with this as a practical thing, which in the end is what I'll be interested in today, is that the dimension of this space is growing linearly with the number of tetrahedra, number of simplices in our triangulation, and the number of vertex rays that you get out of this could well be growing exponentially in T. Right? So it's just like, well, this is sort of silly, but right, if we want to think about the cube in Rn, right, the cube is specified by n equations. On the other hand, it has 2 to the n vertices. And even if it didn't, even if you write down a system of, let's say, n or n plus 1 equations that describes the simplex, all known algorithms for enumerating the vertices take time which is exponential in the number, in the dimension and the number of inequalities. So as a practical thing, you're going to be limited, it turns out, with current computers and so on, you're limited to maybe 40 tetrahedra. After that point, this thing just has too many vertices. You will run out of memory time or both. And so what I'm going to be talking about in part today is ways that you can use some of these ideas and still, in complicated situations, and still get answers at the cost of giving up the fact that you know the algorithm will terminate, that you know you'll get an answer. And there's also, well, maybe no, let's just not talk about that. For certain problems, once you've found the initial surface, you have to cut the manifold open along it and then do normal surface theory on what's left. That's a bad idea because you almost certainly increase vastly the number of tetrahedra. So even if you found the surface in the first place, good luck with the next step. Okay. So I'd now like to talk about a particular theorem that I proved with Dinakar Ramakrishnan, which uses, well, normal surface theory in a modified form. So, well, this is, let me sort of back up and say a little bit about one of the big open questions in three-dimensional topology. Right, so before lunch, Saul was talking about manifolds which fibered over the circle. So you have some surface across the interval, and then you're gluing the top to the bottom of this thing via some diffeomorphism, let's say, of the surface. So that's a surface bundle like this, mapping to the circle. Now this is maybe the simplest kind of three manifold you could imagine, after maybe the three sphere. And so it's a remarkable conjecture usually attributed to Bill Thurston, which is, although this may seem like a very simple kind of three-manifold, it is in fact almost universal. So given any hyperbolic three-manifold M, well, there's no reason to think this manifold will fiber over the circle, and in fact, many, probably most, don't. But the conjecture says there exists a finite cover. So I just mean some covering map of finite degree, local homeomorphism. Each point here has, say, 19 preimages. There exists a finite cover where the new manifold fibers over the circle. So any three-manifold can be reduced by unwrapping it some finite amount to this particularly simple class of three-manifolds. So this is an interesting conjecture, and it's part of a series of questions surrounding something called the virtual Hawking conjecture, which I won't state precisely since this is the form, perhaps the most difficult form that I'd like to focus on today. So whenever you're faced with some problem that you don't know how to solve, right, there's always two things you can do. You can make it easier, require less, and then you can try to prove it, or you could require more and try to disprove it. Or you could require more and exhibit at least one example that has this stronger behavior. So this is asking for a single manifold which fibers over the circle. You might ask for a whole family of covers where the cover N fibers in many different ways. So what does many different ways mean? I think it's a little technical in this context, but roughly speaking, you know, you have this manifold fibering over the circle, you have the suspension of the diffeomorphism that's giving you a foliation, which is dual to the surfaces. And if you take the Pseudo-Anosov representative, that's a flow which has nice Pseudo-Anosov dynamics. And it turns out that there are sometimes other vibrations over the circle for which this dual transverse flow is in fact the same. So you think of moving from one vibration to the other as basically you have a flow and you're picking different sections of that flow. So when that happens, I want to think of those vibrations as basically the same or related. And what this theorem here is saying is there's a hyperbolic three-manifold which has a whole bunch of finite covers, where the number of different ways it fibers is this number Vn. It's the number of fundamentally distinct vibrations. And their covers have this particular degree. And what we show, using a variety of techniques, most of which I will not talk about today, is that the number of, for this particular family of examples, the number of faces is growing, well, that fast, which is it's slower than any power of V, and it's faster than any power of log D. Vn, this thing. No, this is log, right? So Okay, so I mean, the proof of this uses strongly the connection. So arithmetic three manifolds are a particular kind. We heard something about that earlier. And so this proof actually uses a lot of machinery from the theory of automorphic forms. In particular, this manifold starts life as a certain elliptic curve with complex multiplication, and then scary things happen to it, which allow you to control its cohomology, control its Hecke operators. Anyway, that's not what I want to talk about today. Instead, as a context of this conference, I want to talk about a basic problem we encountered. Is we had built this particular manifold M, and we needed to decide whether this three-manifold fibers over the circle. We really wanted it to. If it didn't, then this theorem, we would have to find another example, and that probably would have been impossible. So The problem is that this manifold, the number of tetrahedra involved in the simplest triangulation we could find, was about 130. This is well beyond the limit of any kind of basic normal surface theory that you can do. It just, forget it. But all is not lost. So there's a couple tricks that turn out to be very effective, maybe more effective than they ought to be, for, you know, producing some surfaces and deciding whether they're fibers in a fibration like this without actually mucking about with that polyhedral cone from the earlier slide. So the idea is we want to start with a triangulation of our manifold which has only one vertex, right? So a dimension down, more comprehensible picture would be, you know, we have this triangulation of the torus, right? So it's a nice triangulation, but when we glue it up, all the four corners become the same point. And then there's one more edge, like so. So we could think about this kind of thing, except in three dimensions. It turns out that work of Kasson and Jaco and Rubinstein says you always have a triangulation like this. And in fact, if you minimize the number of tetrahedra in your triangulation, which is a natural thing to want to do in this context, you'll always end up with one vertex, except in one or two silly cases. So here's our trick. We're trying to decide, we have given a cohomology class, a one-dimensional cohomology class. You could think about that as Poincaré dual to a two-dimensional homology class. Or better, in this case, you should think of it as a map from your manifold to the circle. Cohomology is representable. And the question is, you have this map from your manifold to the circle. Is it coming from a fibration like this? Right, so at the moment, we're just thinking the map is specified maybe up to homotopy. So it's unclear. So here's a way you can build. I mean, normally you think of homology or cohomology as something you compute by looking at a matrix, by looking at the kernel of a matrix mod the image of another one. So it's some kind of algebraic information. But you'd like to see that as an actual geometric map of the circle. So your cohomology class is represented by some one cost chain, one cost cycle, that corresponds to simply labeling the edges of your tetrahedra by numbers. And then the cost cycle condition is saying that if you start at a vertex and go the two ways around a triangle, then what you get is the same. So 2 plus 1 is 3. Right. So now we can use that to build a map from this simplex to the circle. And it's going to be a map that sends vertices to vertices, and then it sends edges to something that wraps around the circle some number of times. So like this edge here, which is labeled 2, it's going to be sent to a loop which goes twice around this circle here. And this one will be sent to one that goes 3 times around. And then the cocycle condition is the thing that's going to tell you that that map actually extends over the face of this simplex as an affine map. And similarly, when you look at the level of the entire simplex, again, it will extend to something like this. So really, maybe it's more convincing to think of it like this. Actually, let me tilt this. So this is 1, 2, 1, 3, 2. Thank you, Dora. And so you can think of mapping this onto the line where you put the vertex here. You put this vertex at height 1. You put this vertex at height 2. You put this vertex at height 3. You're just collapsing this linearly down onto the plane, and then you're mapping this down onto the circle of length 1. Okay? So that's a map that's defined just in terms of the cocycle. And now if you take a generic point in the inverse image, on this edge away from the vertex, so in my picture that'd be like picking this point here, which would have a number of copies here, then the inverse image of that is going to be some bunch of surfaces in our thing, which will be these nice normal surfaces. So that gives us a map. It gives us some surface. There's no reason to think a priori that it is the surface in the fibration here, or if we're thinking about simply trying to find the smallest surface in that particular homology or cohomology class, there's no reason to think it's the right one. Maybe it has genus 10 and the minimal one has genus 7. But what it turns out is if you take your triangulation, there are various moves you can perform on it which are analogous in a higher dimension to the swap moves that Saul showed us this morning. You could take your triangulation, you can do some bunch of moves on it like this, and then you can again compute this map, look at the inverse image, now you get another surface. And just keep repeating this. So maybe you see a surface of genus 7, of genus 6, of genus 6, of genus 7, of genus 7, of genus 5. Eventually, you know, you will convince yourself that you know what the genus of the surface is, this minimal genus. And there are techniques, which I don't have time to talk about, but are very classical, coming from the Alexander polynomial, which do give you some lower bounds on the genus. So if the Alexander polynomial is telling you to expect genus 5, and you find a surface of genus 5, then you're done. Rich?
So you're just going to pick a bunch of different cohomology classes and then for each one do this?
That's right. So you could even think, we could think that maybe this thing is simply one-dimensional. The H upper 1 is one-dimensional. So there's essentially only one choice for phi, but there's going to be many choices for the triangulation. You'll get many different surfaces. So once you've found a surface which you now believe is the simplest around, if you want to know if it fibers over the circle, that's equivalent to saying the complement of that surface is a surface cross I. Right? So we think we found a fiber. We think we found that surface there. If we cut it open, we just get this product. And that's, again, something which can be answered by normal surface theory, but it's not something that's at all practical at this size scale. So instead, you can do something, another trick. You can look at a presentation for the fundamental group of this manifold coming from a triangulation, and then there are moves on finitely presented groups that have the potential of simplifying the presentation without changing the underlying group. And so you do these, and you just do these moves, and if you're lucky, where lucky means you randomize a bit, you'll end up with a presentation which is obviously that of a surface. So, you know, if it's the surface of genus 2, you'll end up with A, B, C, D, where the product of the commutator of A and B and the commutator of C and D is 1. And there's a theorem of Stallings, going back to the loop theorem of Dane, that says that if you know what the fundamental group is, if it's just the fundamental group of a surface, it must in fact be the product. And one thing I'm currently working on is trying to relate this to other problems. Can this be used to find incompressible surfaces? Things like that. Okay, so let me switch focus completely. So if I have completely confused you by now, I now get a completely new chance to confuse you a second time. So here's another way of building a free manifold other than gluing tetrahedra, like we talked about so far. So start with a handle body in S3, in R3. So it's everything, it's not just that surface, it's everything inside. It's a three-dimensional manifold with boundary. It might have more holes than two. It might have 10 holes, but I drew one of two. And now we glue the boundary of that manifold together by some homeomorphism of the boundary of this surface to the boundary of that surface. So we just take these two surfaces, these two handle bodies, and we glue them together. So this turns out to be a universal construction. Every closed orientable free manifold can be built in this way for some number of holes and some choice of homeomorphism there, some element of the mapping class group. So a basic invariant then of a free manifold is what is called the these are screwed up. This is what's called the genus, and this is what's called the rank. All right. So the genus of the manifold is simply the minimum number of holes in a description like this, which is what's called the Haygarth splitting. And it turns out that, for instance, the Haygarth genus of the three-sphere is 0. The Haygarth genus of the three-torus is 3. The Haygarth genus of a Lens space is 1. Okay, some numbers. We can also talk about the fundamental group of the free manifold, which is the most important, really only important, algebraic, topological invariant of a free manifold. So
It turns out that if you have a Haggard genus, a Haggard splitting of genus G, it gives you very naturally a presentation for the fundamental group with G generators and G relators. The generators just come from the fundamental group of that handlebody, the free group of rank G. Those turn out to generate the thing because any loop can be pushed off the other handlebody. So if you could also, a natural invariant of a group is its rank, which is simply the minimum size of a generating set. And since a Haggard splitting of genus G leads to a presentation with G generators, they're saying that the rank of the fundamental group is at most the genus. And because part of this is the work of Thurston and Perlman, but fundamental groups of three manifolds are very special. They more or less determine the manifold. And so one of the things you'd like to understand is understand, can you go backwards from the fundamental group to topological information about your free manifold? So here's a question to which we do not know the answer. Is the rank always equal to the genus for any hyperbolic free manifold? So if we look at manifolds which are not hyperbolic, it turns out that this is not always the case. There are some Seifert-Fibert spaces. So a Seifert-Fibert space is simply a three manifold which has a foliation by circles. Or another way, you think of a three manifold, slightly less general, but think of a three manifold with a circle action on it without fixed points. That's an example of a Seifert-Fibert space. It turns out there are examples where the rank is strictly less than the genus. And there are further examples involving gluing these Seifert-Fibert pieces together due to Weidman and Schultens. So what I want to tell you now is about a little work with Helen Wong to find examples where this differs. That's virtually what everybody expects, is that these quantities are different, but no one has been able to show that. So, is it possible to just look for, by brute force or something, examples where these differ? Well, if so, we need to be able to compute the rank and the genus. So in theory, we can compute the rank. That's a theorem of Kapovitch and Weidman. The rank of any Kleinian group is effectively computable. Is the genus computable? That's not currently known. Very likely, yes. This would go back to the idea of normal surfaces. Rubinstein and Stocking showed that these Haggard surfaces, the surface we're gluing along, they typically can be made, well, not normal, but something called almost normal. The problem is, a priori, there are infinitely many candidate surfaces. We don't know they lie on the vertices, so you don't have a finite check. There's work of Tao Li in a certain theoretical applications, which indicates you probably can get around that. And in fact, I think he's working on demonstrating there is an algorithm here. It would be extraordinarily painful if there exists. That's actually true for all these things. If your manifold has cusps, like some of the manifolds Saul was talking about earlier, Lackenby showed that you can, in fact, compute the triangulation if you use the right, compute the genus if you start with the right triangulation. So in practice, how can you compute these things? Well, the rank you can occasionally compute. So the idea is you start with some presentation in terms of generators and relators for your group. Maybe it's generated by three things. Okay? And you can try to wonder, well, is it generated by two things? So just pick two elements in the group, short words in this group, and then you can run something called the Todd-Coxeter coset enumeration algorithm, which attempts to determine the index of the subgroup generated by these two things in the subgroup, in the whole group. And of course, if it comes back and says one, well, you found a new generating set. But if it turns out that subgroup you have is infinite index, then it will run forever. But so it turns out that the way the theorem of Kapovitch and Weidman is that they're basically a priori bounds on how complicated a smaller generating set could be and how long you would have to run the Todd-Coxeter coset enumeration algorithm in order to find a smaller generating set. And of course, these bounds are ineffective and no doubt very large. There are very few lower bounds on the rank. Basically, you can take your group and you can map it to some group whose rank you know, like, for instance, an abelian group, right? Or you can map it to some finite group where you could check what the rank of that finite group is. So the rank is only occasionally computable. The genus is, well, sometimes you can compute it. You can start with some triangulation of your three manifold. There's a presentation of pi 1 that comes from that. You can simplify it by these TT transformations, canceling generators, doing these various little moves. What you get inevitably seems to come from a Haggard splitting of your manifold, and so that then gives you, repeating this process many times, some idea of what you think the Haggard genus should be. And unfortunately, well, that gives you some particular Haggard splitting, so maybe you found one of genus 5 or something. But to get a lower bound on the genus, the only obvious one is the rank. Okay, and that's not very helpful when you're trying to show the rank and the genus differ. One of the few that does exist are what are called quantum invariants that come out of the Jones polynomial, topological quantum field theory. These can be used to give lower bounds on the genus in some cases. And in fact, the examples of Boileau and Zichang that I mentioned before, I didn't say anything about the proof, but it turns out that Helen showed that quantum invariants can be used to give a different proof of what of the difference between genus and rank in those cases. So when I heard about that from Helen, I was very excited because here was a new tool that you could use to give lower bounds on the genus. So what seems reasonable is you want to use that tool to give lower bounds on the genus to try to find an example of a hyperbolic manifold where the rank and the genus differ. So Helen and I started doing this, doing a bunch of computations, basically we failed miserably. We don't currently have any candidate examples where we think the rank and the genus differ. I expected to be able to find some examples and not be able to prove it, because after all, there is no known algorithm for computing the Haggard genus. But we don't have any examples that we think that the rank and the genus differ. Our programs, our search methods, quickly find many of the known non-hyperbolic examples. Like, they will find these examples of Boileau and Zichang very quickly if you just do some kind of random search. And we do think we found a new non-hyperbolic example that's built up out of some fibered spaces and a hyperbolic link complement in the middle. This is the JSJ splitting with the experts. We know that the rank of this group is 3, and we strongly suspect that this should be genus, that the genus of M is 4. But we haven't been able to prove that because, again, the genus is not known to be effectively computable, and even if it were, that algorithm would be useless. Right. I'm almost out of time, so I'll just end with a sort of advertisement for something that I've been doing with Mark Kohler. So Saul mentioned in his talk SnapPete, which is a program that was written by Jeff Weeks in the 90s for studying hyperbolic free manifolds. You give it some topological description. It attempts to find hyperbolic structure on it. This was originally written for early 90s vintage Macintosh computers. It no longer runs, except in emulation, on any computer you can buy today. So Mark Kohler and I have developed a new version, a new interface, to the same underlying C kernel, which is runs on OS X, on Linux, on Windows, on the same way, and on all of these platforms. It's based on the Python programming language. I don't have time, because it's already 3 o'clock, to tell you anything about it, or to demo it, which I think nominally my abstract claimed that I would, but no loss, because it's all on YouTube. There's a couple of tutorials where I run through the basic features. So far people have really liked my YouTube video. It's also you notice it's been watched 169 times. I'm not sure why. Are there really 169 people who... I'm not complaining. So this is all available. It's all freely downloadable, open source, blah, blah, blah. I'd be happy to show it to anybody, sometime later this afternoon if people are interested. So I will stop there. Thank you for your attention.